Welcome to the Hirschfeld Century Podcast. I'm Catherine Eastman, the Archives Manager of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation.
And I'm David Leopold, the Creative Director.
And now we've come to the portion of our program where we have our special mystery guest. Mystery guest, will you come in and sign in, please? Today we have a very special guest.
Our very special guest today is Doug Coons, the media director for the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. If you follow us on social media, whether it's on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, you're seeing the work of Doug Coons. If you've seen any of our videos on YouTube, that is the work of Doug Coons. And if you've been listening to this podcast over the last year, while Catherine and I are the people on the program, it's Doug who produces it and makes us sound good. So you know the work of Doug Coons. We're bringing him on today for a very special reason. What is the subject of today's podcast?
Today's podcast is about Disney.
Welcome, Doug.
It's the centennial of Disney Studio.
Yeah, thank you for having me on today. So I have been sort of behind the microphone, as it were, for the past year in the podcast. We've done some really fun episodes. And yes, in case anybody's wondering, they really are like this in real life. This is not an act.
No, this is not an act. I couldn't act.
Unfortunately.
I'm a lifelong Disney fan. I was a Disney kid and arguably still am a Disney kid now. And, you know, a lot of these movie studios are having their 100th anniversaries. We did the Warner Brothers podcast a few months ago. And so we knew, obviously, Disney just had their 100th anniversary back in October. So we really wanted to do an episode about that. And as the unofficial Disney expert of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation, I am here today to give the Disney perspective.
No, I was going to say you are the official Disney expert.
Without a doubt.
I used to be.
Oh, yeah.
I used to be.
Catherine's been displaced.
I used to go to the animation studios with David, and he could talk about, you know, the Hirschfeld, all that boring stuff. But I could talk to the animators. Oh, I did Kronk on Emperor's New Groove. Oh, you were the animator for Kronk. Oh, it's so... And David's like, what are they talking about? But now, you know, I also, I'm a 90s kid. So I have all the Renaissance, the Disney Renaissance movies. But Doug has all the Pixar and all the later Disney stuff.
21st century.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but I was lucky being a 2000s kid that a lot of movies were coming out to DVD for the first time, and they loaded them with bonus features. So when I should have been paying attention in math class and science class, I just spent my time studying Disney movies.
But it did turn out that watching those features was actually the smartest thing you might have done when you were in school, because it helped you get this job. You were, when we were advertising for a new team member, Doug was the only person who responded who talked about Hirschfeld in their cover letter.
That's true.
And it was because you had watched the Aladdin bonus material, which talks about Hirschfeld.
Yeah, they have a whole, they had a 2-hour program on the one DVD, and they had like a 5-minute sort of like mini featurette where Eric Goldberg talks about Hirschfeld, talks about, you know, it's a little bit about Bali, which, you know, we did the podcast episode last year on. But I did also have another early experience with Hirschfeld in my middle school art class. We were one day shown some of Hirschfeld's artwork where we were supposed to look for the Ninas. I was really bad at it. So I have now spent my time here so far trying to make up for my younger failings.
Well, now we know Doug's origin story for both Hirschfeld and Disney.
Well, we're happy to have you, and we're excited to get into this very special episode.
Because it turns out that there is a lot of Hirschfeld connection to Disney, much more than you might think.
And there's also some very interesting sides of Hirschfeld that are a little different than, you know, just some of Hirschfeld's drawings or some other aspects of Hirschfeld's work too in this.
Well, yes, we're going to really get into the heart of what Hirschfeld saw as what makes a good drawing, what makes a good animated film. He talked about this and he wrote about it. The first time he drew a Disney character was Mickey Mouse, not surprisingly. And that was not for a Disney film, but in one of the rare instances where Mickey appeared in another studio's film, which was in 1934 for a really regrettable film called Hollywood Party. This is one of those review-style films where there's all these little segments that are sort of pieced together. Jimmy Durante is this sort of Tarzan-like character, and he throws a party, and Laurel and Hardy come, and Jack Pearl, and Polly Moran, and all, you know...
Three Stooges.
I mean, it's, again, appearing in a non-Columbia feature. And Hirschfeld did the posters for this film. He did four posters for this film that were these wonderful collections of all the stars who were in the film. And among them was Mickey Mouse. And I think his Mickey is sort of Steamboat Willie Mickey. His nose is a little bit longer, and you know he's not the Mickey that we all know, but a little bit different because he was still really discovering himself, as it were. Or Disney was discovering who it was. So that's the first time we see a Disney character in a Hirschfeld drawing. And then in 1937, Hirschfeld does these drawings for a very funny piece in the New York Times Magazine section, in which the article is titled, Mickey Mouse Can Be All Things to All Men. And it's a satirical article that talks about how every country really had adapted and adopted Mickey as sort of their own, and they gave him different names, and there were Mickey Mouse clubs all over the world. And the writer says in Yugoslavia, they say that they see Mickey as a revolutionary, whereas in Russia, they see him as a capitalist. And Hirschfeld drew both of those scenes. In this episode, you should definitely follow along in the show notes to see. He did three drawings of Mickey for this piece, and they're all really wonderful and very funny.
I remember we posted these three drawings a few years ago on Facebook, and people were very offended.
Really?
What does Hirschfeld have against Mickey Mouse? And so it does. It's almost, you almost need to read the articles to kind of understand the drawings.
Sure.
Because they are kind of very, I wouldn't say dark, but it's not like whatever Mickey's voice is. Like, you know, it's not a fun. It's not Mickey Mouse like being cute and fun. It's. Like yeah. I said, not dark, but just kind of different. I remember people like, what does Hirschfeld have against Disney or Mickey Mouse? So.
And it's really fascinating because, you know, you got to think 1937, Mickey Mouse debuted in 1928. So it was only 9 years later. And, you know, I kind of, you know, think back then pop culture moves a lot slower than it does today, just because, you know, they just didn't have the same way of information getting out, and just seeing, you know, really the phenomenon that Mickey Mouse was and how influential he became. And I just think that it's just very fascinating seeing then these also different interpretations where he really is still, even though it's only been 9 years, I mean, he's still this sort of new figure on the scene even then. And it's kind of different now looking at just the reactions of people nowadays looking at it, having like this, you know, very different reaction to someone who now has just been a household name for so long.
Right. And Mickey in the 1930s was much more impish. And sort of almost Bart Simpson-like character than he would become in later films. He'd really become a sweet, wonderful kid who'd get his hand caught in the cookie jar, but not like impish in the way that he was in these earlier films. And it resonated. Like Chaplin, all over the world, you know, Mickey, everybody got Mickey. You know, no one could say that Mickey wasn't, you know, he wasn't like anybody else, so everybody could adopt him.
Mickey, you could say Mickey Mouse can be all things to all men.
I've heard it said.
So they say.
Well, now, but the same year that Hirschfeld draws this, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the first feature from Walt Disney Studios. And Hirschfeld is excited because he loves animated film. He loves animation, and he reviews it for the New York Times with a really unusual drawing of Walt Disney to go along with it. And he had a personal connection to Snow White. She told me the story. March Champion, the great dancer, was a longtime friend of Al Hirschfeld's. And she was just 18 years old when she met Hirschfeld, when she was then Marjorie Belcher was dating Hirschfeld's good friend, Alexander King. And as Marge told me the story, that she, her relationship with King was a little bit difficult. She felt that he was cheating on her. And she went to Hirschfeld's studio just and started to pour out her heart. You know, she said she went up there and, you know, so Al would have been, you know, in his late 20s, early 30s. She's this 18-year-old girl. And she starts saying about how Alex is cheating on her. And she pours out her heart. She's crying. She said the whole time Hirschfeld was drawing. And when she gets to sort of the end of her...
Her vent.
Well, she ends up by saying, "What should I do, Al?" And he looks up from his drawing, she told me, and he said, "Grow up." And she said that was the best piece of advice that she would ever get. She would eventually leave Alexander King, and she would marry Art Babbitt, who was an animator at Disney. And they had probably met because Disney had cast her as Snow White. She was the sort of human figure that they based Snow White on. Her father had been a dance teacher in California. Walt had found her there. And they would film her twirling around, moving around. She would wear sort of similar clothes or sometimes even a helmet to get the Snow White's coiffed hair. And she did this all anonymously. You know, she said at the opening of Snow White, she sat up in the balcony. Mm-hmm. You know, they never said, you know, based on Marge Champion or anything like that. She would end up being two other characters in Disney films. She would be the Blue Fairy in Pinocchio, and she was one of the hippopotamuses in Fantasia. And strangely enough, those are the films that Hirschfeld reviewed for the New York Times. Yeah. And, of course, they were friends their whole lives. Hirschfeld would be great friends. He would stay friends with Art Babbitt his whole life. But then when Marge married Gower Champion, of course, they spent a lot of time together. And they were friends all the way up until Al's death. And, of course, Marge lived to be like 101. And she was always part of the sort of extended Hirschfeld family. So he had a direct connection to Snow White. And I'm sure he was very excited to see it when he went to it. But what he wrote in his review for the New York Times is not exactly what Disney would have liked, because he thought that he loved the dwarfs in Snow White, but he had some issues with Snow White herself. As he wrote in the piece, quote, "The illusion created by a well-directed pen line is an art not to be confused with the gingerbread realities of Snow White. Disney's treatment of these characters, Snow White, Prince Charming, and the Queen, belong to the oopsie-whoopsie school of art practiced mostly by etchers who portray dogs with cute, with a K, sayings. Snow White, with her full complement of fingers and fingernails, eyelashes, one-dimensional head, bare arms without solidity, and uninventive neck, is an awkward automaton. These awkward symbols do not articulate, and the lovely voice with which she is endowed only heightens the effect of a ventriloquist dummy. The staccato movements of Snow White and her cardboard lover, both wired for sound, are distinctly bad influences in this new art form. To imitate an animated photograph, except as satire, is in poor taste." See, Hirschfeld thought that the idea of recreating reality in an animated cartoon was a mistake. If you wanted to see people with five fingers on their hand and moving like a human being, you had the human being. But the success in Snow White is not Snow White, it's the dwarfs. You know, although the dwarfs are very much caricatures, you know, they're exaggerated. They feel more real than Snow White and Prince Charming, who are like mannequins in this. I mean, that's what really he's pointing out. As he would later write later in the review, "In Disney's less ambitious works, there is a unity of figures and background. But now he is working backward to realistic photography." And then he goes on to predict what I think is the sort of future of the Disney studio up until the 90s. With a little imagination, one can foresee the use of constructed miniature sets with three-dimensional puppets mechanically operated on them. From this innocuous departure, a quote, mediocre genius, unquote, could once more revolutionize the motion picture industry by reverting to human beings instead of puppets. And he finished with this: put me down as an eccentric, but I still prefer wood, and metal, and caricature. You know, he felt this was a missed opportunity by Disney, that by trying to imitate reality, it seemed less so. Mm. Whereas the caricature and what he could see in his own works, I mean, he's discovering this in his own work at that time. It's very interesting that Disney and Hirschfeld kind of start around the same time, and they discovered, and Disney animators as opposed to just Disney himself, discovered that rounded forms work much better than angular forms, and that you can imbue more character in them. And that's what Hirschfeld understood, is he was trying to get the character of what was going on, and Disney was trying to find the same thing. So in some ways, they're working on parallel tracks. And so when it's rare to get Hirschfeld to sort of step out of his track and talk about Disney, but here we have, this was published in the New York Times, and it's quite, I think, revealing and an interesting analysis of this film, which so many people were just bowled over by because they'd never really seen an animated feature like this before. He would go on to review Pinocchio. And let me just say this. The review of Snow White is called An Artist Contests Mr. Disney. His review of Pinocchio is Disney versus Art. It's already a bad sign. So 2 years later, he reviews Pinocchio, and he sets it up as in a very interesting way. He says that while most people looked at Pinocchio as box office entertainment, he saw a few artists who were interested in the subject looked at Disney's work as, quote, primarily drawings, the gallery being a movie house rather than a modern museum. So he was taking this seriously. This was not cute things or, haha, let's look at that cartoon. He saw this as a legitimate art form, I think, before many other people did. But he had a lot of issues with it. He thought the realistic background and the way that they drew Geppetto to try to be so realistic made them look very stiff and not realistic, whereas, in his words, the puppets seem more real than the toy maker. And then he goes on to say, he was interested and annoyed at the constant battle for supremacy between the background illustrations with their molasses modeling and their brilliantly articulated images invading them. He cited Fleischer Studio out of the Inkwell as a cartoon studio that successfully handled the dichotomy between realistic and cartoon, and, you know, really caricature in this case. He does say in Pinocchio the thoroughly satisfying drawings of Jiminy Cricket's head is close-up clearly show the potentialities of magical line. Very interesting, magical line. When his stylized eyeballs trace the varied rhythms of the pendular clocks. And he finished his critique by observing that, quote, technical advances should be used to further the original genius of animation and not to produce novelties. We are no longer amazed that motion pictures talk. We are now interested in what they have to say. And so it is with animated drawing. So that for him, this was a very crucial moment that he hoped Disney would take advantage of an animation. You were not constrained by reality. Just like, you know, when Hirschfeld draws Ray Bolger is amazed by it because there's no gravity in Hirschfeld drawings. You know, he's not constrained by the reality of the situation. That's sort of the magic of Hirschfeld's work. Even though he's giving us a very, in many cases, detailed depiction of what's going on stage, it's not something that you're going to actually see when you go to the theater. It's going to suggest what you see at the theater. It's going to capture the character of the show rather than the specifics of the show.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And, you know, because when I first read Hirschfeld's reviews for these, I mean, it took me a couple times to go through them, but one thing I really had to think of was just the perspective at the time. I mean, this is, you know, the beginning of feature animation. You know, I think he saw a possibility with it, that it could go in all these different directions, but I think at the same time, you know, looking at the making of these films, there was a lot of, you know, challenges in sort of mining this, you know, new version of this art form that made some of that a little bit difficult. And just to show how much of a Disney fan I am, you know, I went to school for TV film production, and my first essay I wrote in my TV film history class was about how Walt Disney used his Silly Symphony shorts as testing grounds for technology for making Snow White. So, you know, I did this analysis of these different, you know, shorts that they had made. And one of them was about sort of working on human figures. It wasn't until 1934, which is 3 years before Snow White would come out, that they did the short film The Goddess of Spring. And it's sort of this mythological story inspired by, like, Hades and Persephone, you know, that sort of, you know, Greek myth. And they had with Persephone this human character. It was the first time they really tried to do this fully utilized human character. And, you know, the final product, the character, they called her very noodly, you know, the way she kind of moved around, her arms were flapping. And I think they had a little bit more of an abstract look that they weren't really able to get right. It just looked wrong. And so it's around this time that they start developing Snow White. It was about 3 year production process before the movie came out. And they had a lot of challenges with animating the human characters to the point where when they started making the film, they started with the dwarfs because that was more of what they had already done, you know, the gags. It got to the point where they had animated so many sequences of the dwarfs that they had to cut 3 fully animated sequences because they eventually, you know, halfway through production, still needed to add the human characters, and they're really the main part of the story. And that was something that was, you know, was very tough. They started doing the live action, you know, reference like they did with Marge Champion. And I think, you know, looking at, you know, with Walt Disney at this time, you know, the newspapers were running, you know, it's Disney's folly, you know, no one really believed in it. And I think more, I don't even want to call it elite people sort of in Hollywood at the time who just didn't think that animation could be as sophisticated. So I think there was also a little bit of an approach there of trying to make it more that way. But now looking at, you know, Hirschfeld, someone who is doing this line, I mean, he, you know, sees it in a different way that I don't think a lot of other people were even expecting Disney to reach that kind of level. They were looking for something different. And, you know, looking at Pinocchio, I think, you know, when he compliments Jiminy Cricket, I think the thing that's fascinating with that is Jiminy Cricket looks the least like what he's supposed to be compared to the other characters. When they were designing Pinocchio, the animator started with, like, a much more wooden puppet style. And, you know, they didn't think it was working. And they said, start human first and add some puppet features later. Same with, you know, the Blue Fairy has a very similar kind of, you know, maybe a little more of a stiff human style like the characters in Snow White did. You know, so, like, just throughout the filming, there is a lot of that more, you know, everyone looks kind of what they were. But Jiminy Cricket, you know, I think, you know, maybe they would have thought, you know, making him look like a cricket would have also been unappealing. So they, you know, they made him really his own thing.
Right. And I think in support of what Hirschfeld's saying, Jiminy Cricket doesn't look like a cricket, yet we totally buy into it. You never watch that film and say, well, you know, he doesn't really look like a cricket, you know, and you don't sit there and say, is he a grasshopper or a cricket? You know, it's none of those things. We're going to post, by the way, the reviews so you'll be able to read them yourself, because he has some negative things to say about the Blue Fairy in Pinocchio. His comments are of disappointment, not because he thought it was bad. Well, I mean, he did think it was bad artistically, but he was disappointed because he thought they could do so much more.
Yeah, he saw potential in the art form.
Exactly. Exactly. And just to give Marge Champion her due, she also dressed in bulky clothes and did dances as Dopey. So when he moves around, that's Marge Champion too.
And if you want to see those performances, they are on the Snow White DVDs if you have an edition of that. They do. So she does now get her credit that she didn't get at the time.
So the same year that Pinocchio comes out, Disney also releases Fantasia. And Hirschfeld does write a review of this, but it never gets published. Probably for good reason. I mean, maybe Hirschfeld was pleased that it didn't get published. I didn't ever have a chance to talk to him about it. But here's some quotes from that review. With every successive spectacle emanating from Mr. Disney Studio, the good drawings get better and the bad drawings become more profuse. In his latest adventure, the drawings, with few exceptions, are uninspired creations of spun sugar. The original simplicity of animated line drawing is a far cry from the greeting card and Futuramas he now employs. Wow, those are heavy words. He writes, "The wedding of sound and pictures is an unhappy marriage. Most of the time, they are fighting, and sound invariably has its way. In many scenes throughout the film, the obvious use of photographs translated into line drawings is apparent. I much prefer a drawing that does bad in its own way. Mickey Mouse, as an illustration of my point, is pure invention. He is not anatomically restricted to the movements of a mouse. His geometric head, gloved forefingers, and large shoes are easily adapted to any costume. A flowing robe, a dunce-like hat, a hypnotic gesture with his hands, and becomes the Sorcerer's Apprentice. This quality can never be duplicated with the labored, self-conscious tracing of a photo. He likes the animals in Dance of the Hours and says the drawings stand out like a diamond in a sea of fudge. And he concludes by saying that Fantasia is an illustrated lecture with music. So
tell us how you really feel. Yeah. About
there is no drawing to go with this review that I know of. There was a drawing that he did for the Pinocchio review that was not run, but that I have seen, and unfortunately we don't have a reproduction of. It was a drawing of Pinocchio working a marionette of Walt Disney. Mm. And it's in a private collection, and we just don't have a good reproduction of it. So Hirschfeld was intimately involved in looking at Disney's work, and it turns out not to be surprising that Disney animators were looking at Hirschfeld's work. As I've said before, they had been studying his drawings for years because he was doing essentially what they were trying to do, making us care about lines on a piece of paper, you know, because when it gets down to it, that's all that Hirschfeld's work is. Yet it seems like so much more. It seems so lively. And that's exactly what Disney was doing. We care about the dwarfs. Why do we care about the dwarfs? Why do we care about Pinocchio? Because they've imbued character into those lines, and we relate to them. We can't say, oh, I know someone just like that, although they're based on people we know. You know, even Eric Goldberg, which, by the way, we did a wonderful interview with Eric Goldberg, and we'll provide a link to that. That was from about 5 years ago, where he talks about Disney and Hirschfeld, which is also very revealing and very wonderful.
You know, it's very interesting reading Hirschfeld's perspectives on these films. One thing is, I wish he did more of them. Because, I mean, the thing is, you know, I know, you know, in this sort of trilogy of reviews, you know, there is this sort of, you know, every time, you know, he's hoping for more and it doesn't meet that. And he gets more disappointed about it. But, you know, these three films were made very close together. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, Pinocchio and Fantasia came out in the same year. So there really wasn't a lot of time for Disney to evolve. Like, I would have liked to hear, like, you know, he talks a lot about, like, the backgrounds of Pinocchio. And, like, when you get into the 50s Disney, you get the Mary Blair style. You know, she did the backgrounds for Cinderella, Alice in Wonderland, Peter Pan. And they're very fascinating. They're very vivid. I mean, she's, one of my favorite artists. Just because I think she just had such a great sense of style. Or you've got Evan Earle, I believe is his name, who did Sleeping Beauty in 1959. And I mean, that film is a work of art. And at the time, you know, the character designs, you know, that's sort of the prime of the nine old men, for people who know their Disney mythology, of the, you know, the nine key animators at the time who, when, you know, Walt Disney was focusing on other projects, his parks, live action films. Yeah, you know, these people are really the ones that were, you know, getting the films together, directing it, doing the character animation. And I think there became a lot more uniqueness in that. So I would have liked to have heard, you know, Hirschfeld's perspective on those kind of films too.
Well, and Hirschfeld knew a lot of the animators. So right around this time, probably 1943, we don't have an exact date, Hirschfeld told me that he had gone to California to interview Walt Disney. He had started doing a series of profiles for the magazine section of the New York Times, Fred Allen, Charlie Chaplin, really great pieces. And he had convinced the editors of the magazine section that Disney, here was this artist businessman, and that would make a great profile. And they said, go for it. And so he took a train out west, and he was met at the train by a group of Disney animators. I'm sure it was led by Art Babbitt. They go out to dinner and drinks and whatnot, and Hirschfeld tells them what he's there for, and they start telling him that Walt is not a very good artist, and that his Mickey Mouse is not something you'd want to see, that his Mickey Mouse looks like a rat. And so they take him in to Disney Studios, and they pull out Walt Disney's drawings of Mickey Mouse, and sure enough, Hirschfeld thinks they look like a rat. And now I'm sure a lot of these animators had been burned badly by Disney just about 18 months earlier when there was a strike. The animators called a strike at Disney. It was a very contentious situation that was eventually resolved, but Disney never forgave the animators. And I don't think the animators really ever forgave Disney. It was a real crack in the whole Disney facade. And a lot of those animators over the next couple of years would leave, including Art Babbitt. Well, Hirschfeld hears all this. So the next morning he gets up, goes to the train station, and goes back home. He never interviews Disney because it's not what he thought it was. Mm. I always think that's Hirschfeld. He makes his decisions. He goes with it.
Well, and that's very interesting because I think it's, you know, there was sort of, I think, especially at the time, this conception that, you know, Walt Disney himself was like the designer guy. These really were his characters that he physically created. But I mean, that really was never the case, you know, for Mickey Mouse. I mean, Ub Iwerks, who, by the way, I should point out, Ub Iwerks, the physical creator of Mickey Mouse, Walt Disney and Al Hirschfeld all grew up in Missouri, born around the same time, different parts of Missouri, but...
Must be something in the water.
Must be. So he was the physical creator of Mickey Mouse, but Walt Disney really got a lot of the credit. And I believe it was around 1941 where there was this big rift between Walt Disney and Ub Iwerks. They were, legend tells that they were at an event and a kid came up to Walt Disney and asked him to draw Mickey Mouse. So then the kid hands him the paper and the pen, takes it, gives it to Ub Iwerks and says, draw Mickey Mouse. And he got very offended. You know, he was very offended by it because, you know, it felt like he wasn't getting the credit. You know, Walt was going to get the credit for the drawing. So he left the Disney studio. He did eventually come back later on. He got into a special effects work. But I think it is a very interesting thing. And then it goes into just, again, how a lot of these characters really are from other animators. It's very similar also, as an aside, to thinking about, they talk about like Marvel now with like Stan Lee and his artists as well, that, sure, you know, he came up with the characters, but it was the other artists who really physically made the drawings. So I think it's very interesting.
And Hirschfeld was lucky. He was his own one-man band. You know, he did not have assistants. He did not really take direction from anybody. What you saw on the page was what Hirschfeld wanted to do. So in some ways, he had a much freer ability to create than any of the Disney animators. And I think the Disney animators understood that. And they could see what he was doing. You know, these were sort of friends in line, as it were. You know, they could, they saw what each of them were doing and appreciated it. And Disney animators, it's like I said, they could not have avoided seeing it because it was in movie posters, it was in newspapers, it was in magazines, there had been book covers. There were just, you know, in the early 40s, we start getting the album covers. And so they're seeing it all the time. So it has a big effect on them. And Disney characters show up in Hirschfeld's drawings in a number of other places. It also in 1937, and I can't figure out why, but there must have been something. The new International Casino opened in Times Square. This was not a casino, but it was called that. It was on the east side of Times Square. It was a very sophisticated nightclub, and Hirschfeld does a drawing that shows this wild staircase, and there's a horse, and there's people in costume, and there's Mickey Mouse dancing around. And I've tried to look at reviews. You know, they don't review opening of nightclubs in the same way as they review Broadway shows. So I couldn't find where does the Mickey Mouse come in. But I'm sure it was part of it.
Mickey Mouse loves casinos, apparently.
Well, that would become the Bonds. It was a clothing store. And that's actually drawn by Hirschfeld in 1949 in a drawing for a show called All for Love with Paul and Grace Hartman. It shows the two of them in between the sign that for Bonds. And then Bonds, that would eventually close down. And in the late 70s and early 80s, it became this really iconic music venue where all the punk and new wave bands played. The Clash played a 12-night run at the Bonds Casino that is legendary. Let's just put it that way. There's a Mickey in the movies in 1955. Donald Duck is in Be in the Set, you know, television personalities, also of the same years. Unlikely places to find Hirschfeld drawing Disney characters are the Ice Capades. In 1954 and in 1958, Hirschfeld did drawings of the Ice Capades. And I know that Catherine's thinking, Freddie Trinkler.
Hirschfeld loves a good ice show. I love his ice drawings. I think he really enjoyed the ice shows because the drawings are always really great.
Well, starting in 1949, the Ice Capades started to have Disney characters as part of the show.
Disney on Ice.
Well, that actually, Ice Capades eventually becomes Disney on Ice.
Wow.
And so starting in 1949, every annual edition of the Ice Capades has Disney characters in it. Mm. Hirschfeld has the Seven Dwarfs on ice skates.
Did you ever go to Disney on Ice?
No, I never went. I went to the Ice Capades.
I have not been to Disney
no?
on Ice.
No? Oh, it was a big thing when I was little. I know we saw Beauty and the Beast, Cinderella. Trying to think.
Well, that was the height of it, I think.
Yeah, in the 90s. Yeah. It was a big deal, Disney on Ice.
Well, with the Ice Capades, they had these costumes for living people. And when they opened Disneyland, Walt Disney borrowed those costumes for people to wear and eventually would take some of the performers who were in the Ice Capades and had them perform at Disneyland. Oh. Wild. Maybe one of the best, if you really want to see Disney characters by Hirschfeld, 1973 drawing of the Disney characters at the Algonquin Round Table.
What's the occasion for this?
So a very landmark book called The Order of Walt Disney is published that year by Harry Abrams. And Hirschfeld had a relationship with Harry Abrams. They had published World of Hirschfeld 3 years before. And they reached out to him. And I don't think they said put all the Disney characters at the Algonquin Round Table. I don't know who thought that was a good idea, but Hirschfeld thought it was a good idea. And sure enough, if you know the classic Algonquin Round Table and you look at the Disney Algonquin Round Table, it's hilarious because those characters are Pluto and Goofy.
I wonder, we haven't really looked very hard at this drawing. Do they correspond? Do the characters correspond to the true Round Table members?
Well,
is this Disney's or is this Hirschfeld's interpretation? Who would Dorothy Parker be? You know, who is Robert Benchley? Is he Daffy Duck?
Well, I know that Frank Case in the original drawing is Walt Disney himself.
Well, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, well, he was the host, as it were. Yeah.
Well, one thing that I think it's interesting, so there's a variety of characters in this drawing. Two of them were Snow White and Pinocchio. First thing I did after I read Hirschfeld's review was I looked back at the drawing and kind of compared his interpretation to the original versions. And they're very close, but I think about, he talks about Snow White, has stiff arms and stuff. Here it feels like she's flowing a little bit more. There's a little more expressiveness in the eyes. I mean, same with Pinocchio, Hirschfeld's very good at keeping the spirit of the animated character. You know, he did the Looney Tunes.
Wonder Brothers.
He did those ones as well. And they feel very similar to the original, but this, I feel like why don't I just make this little tweak? That's my interpretation of it.
I agree. And I don't think he perfectly recreates the round table image, but it's pretty close. Lawton Fontaine, or give it over to human figures, Julie Andrews and Peter Ustinov. Does he think that George Kaufman is Pluto? I don't think so.
And there's two specific Hirschfeld works of a Disney film that I wanted to shout out. Hirschfeld did these two, I think, really beautiful prints of Mary Poppins, which I would say, because shouting out another podcast episode recently, did prints. If I had to pick my favorite prints, which prints would I want? Those would be my prints, because it's one of my favorite films, and I really like how he draws them.
It would be nice to have a bookend Mary Poppins prints.
Oh, sure.
Wouldn't that be nice?
You can do that if you go to our shop, Al Hirschfeld Foundation, shop.org.
That's true.
A mere $8,000, you can go home today with both those prints. Hirschfeld also drew Disney. In addition to that drawing he did for the review of Snow White, he drew, and the images that he did for the reviews, he shows up in a drawing with Hirschfeld, Americans in London, at the Caprice restaurant. There's all these characters, celebrities in it, and Disney is one of them. And Al and Dolly are coming through the revolving door in the drawing. So Disney shows up in that. There is actually a great drawing of Disney from when he showed a preview of Peter Pan on the Omnibus TV show in 1952. Two or something.
That's a fun one because there's actually like scenes from Peter Pan
Yes. That
Hirschfeld drew in the, it's like a film strip or, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it was a great TV program because on the same program with Disney and Peter Pan, you also have William Faulkner reading. I mean, it's, when would that happen today? Mm. And then of course, there's a great portrait of Disney in an Appointment with O'Hara column.
Oh yeah.
Collier's
drawings, man.
Yeah,
they're always killer. Some of my favorite drawings are Collier's drawings.
Yeah.
They really are. They always get to the point. I think because it was a small drawing right. And he knew he's got to distill everything down to this. I mean, when I say they're small drawings, I'm talking about the magazine, which is actually a quite large magazine, the Collier's magazine. But the drawings in them, 2 inches by 2 inches, and that's being kind of generous.
And he did the drawings on smaller board. I mean,
smaller boards. They're actually physically smaller drawings than normal Hirschfeld drawings. But I always love them. And that is, you're right, it is a really nice portrait of him.
And it's really the precursor to the Friday drawings.
Exactly.
Where he learns to say a lot in a very small space.
And similar to the interior TV guides as well.
Right.
Very similar.
Right. So then we get into something, you know, his last film poster was for a Disney film, although the subsidiary of Disney, Touchstone Pictures, and that was the poster for Noises Off, the film adaptation of the stage show. And that is, I mean, that is 72 years after his first film drawing, is his last film poster. And then he would continue drawing films for another 10 years. And then in 92, the same year, Disney releases Aladdin. Mm. Now, this is really where the parallel tracks start to meet.
Yeah.
Although Disney animators had been studying Hirschfeld's drawings for decades, in Aladdin, the animator of the genie, Eric Goldberg, freely admits that the genie is completely based on Hirschfeld drawings. And he says something very interesting. He says, thing about Hirschfeld is great is for the strength in his poses. They are very readable from a long, long distance away. They have a great deal of elegance from line to line, leading organically to the next. And there are a lot of dynamics in the poses. You know, and Hirschfeld often spoke about how you can tell a friend a block away. You just see his form and you know who it is or you know something about that person. And that is what Eric Goldberg was picking up on. You know, this is sort of artists looking at artists' work and being inspired by it. You know, us civilians, we look at it and we think, oh, that person looks really like themselves or that drawing looks really like that. But another artist is looking, how does he capture that essence?
What is it about the drawing
right.
that communicates that to us?
And, you know, Hirschfeld is inspired also by shadow puppets, which again is the outline of a figure, and he understood how that could convey a lot of character. And so when Eric, who really, if all Disney animators liked Hirschfeld's work, Eric was a particular, he liked him more than others. So it was a great thrill for him to create this character. And as he told me when they were showing an early version in New York, they tell Eric that, they don't tell Eric. He goes there and he sits right next to Hirschfeld. This made him a little nervous. Listen to the interview. You should. He tells a very funny story about that.
I'm very jealous that you guys got to do that interview because that's. I mean, Eric Goldberg is someone who watching this stuff. I mean, I've, heard of all my life. So I think it's. I'm very jealous of you guys for that. But it's a really. It is a really great interview.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, through Aladdin, Eric meets Hirschfeld. And the two become friends. They're speaking the same language. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when Eric and his wife Susan would come to New York, they would stay at the Hirschfelds. And then he invited Al out to Disney Studios to talk to animators. And Al went out. And I so remember this. I probably said it before. He came back and we were in the studio. And I said, well, how was it? And he was telling me about this or that. And then he says, they have 1,500 people working, 1,500 artists working on the same film, which turned out to be Pocahontas.
Shout out, my favorite Disney movie. I will not let Pocahontas be canceled.
No.
I won't stand for it. I'm a firm believer and supporter of Pocahontas. Great movie.
You
great,
can step down from your soapbox.
Yeah, great music. Don't get me started.
Visually beautiful film.
It is. It is. And I, I'm a colonial gal myself, so I always loved it.
We wanted to find out who the colonial people oppressed, and so.
Well, I when it came out, we were living in Virginia, so yeah. I think that was a big part of it too.
Sure.
Like, oh yeah, I'm really proud of this.
Well, Hirschfeld comes back. He's 1,500 artists, and he says to me. With all, he was serious. He's like, I don't know of any time where I've seen three artists that could work on something together without getting into a fight. Mm. And what really amazed him is that these 1,500 artists were working on the same project and it looked like the hand of one person.
Yeah, we often don't, I don't think that, more than one hand drew this film, for any Disney movie or any animation, really. And you don't think about that. That's, I think, a tribute to the talent of them all working together.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Greater cause.
And I think you do see something very interesting with Aladdin. I mean, it has very, bright, colorful, vivid backgrounds, but it has a more stylized feeling to it than I think, what came before it. And the character designs throughout, that every character feels like it has their own shape. It has their own silhouette to
None
it.
None are the same. None are very similar. They're all very different.
Well, Jafar, the villain in the film, is based on Erte drawings. Mm. They're not, so you have these two different artists, really, and they're using those contrasting, similar but contrasting ideas to present the characters. Mm. And Aladdin is a film that is not weighed down by realistic backgrounds. It's there. The things that they're doing are, based in reality, but they're not interested in capturing every last detail. That's not the important part.
And, if you look at, when they're in, the streets of Agrabah, and you, look at the buildings in the background, the way that they move it and sort of almost, they're in different sort of, maybe angles. I won't say it's fully German expressionistic, but it is more stylized than I think what happens in the past. I think that really does fulfill something that Hirschfeld was talking about in 1940.
Right, and not surprisingly, it's a huge hit. I remember when there were ads in the paper at that time. The ads were in black and white, and. The ads had all these hands sort of pointing, it had the genie and hands, and they were Hirschfeld hands.
Right.
And he and I would laugh about it because it was quite obvious.
They were
Hirschfeld hands. But he didn't see it as they're ripping me off.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He was amused. It tickled him that they were doing that. and of course, Eric wants to work with Hirschfeld. And he and Susan start working on a piece that was originally slated for the new Fantasia, called, it was going to be Rhapsody in Blue. And Disney then says, no, that music's too modern. We won't be able to include it. And so...
So funny. What's Rhapsody in Blue from? The 30s?
Yes. But the rest of the music is from the 1800s. Yeah, you know,
it's the only one they had a license for the film.
Oh, really? Mm. The one that, interesting.
It was only 60 years before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it's 100 years now, practically.
It's so funny, though, that jazz, they're like, no. That won't do.
And it's only when, you know, the original idea of Fantasia 2000 was to mix in the old with the new.
Mm.
And when they ran it, you know, for people in Disney, it was quite obvious that that wasn't going to work. And Eric and Susan had been moving along with Rhapsody in Blue, sort of developing what they wanted to do with it. And he had gotten the idea that he wanted Hirschfeld to create the characters. He wanted them to create like 50 characters that they could use in the film. And they talked to him about it, and Al thought about it, but eventually would write them a letter saying, this is another career. This is, it's a great idea, but I don't think I want to do it, but good luck with it. But Eric and Susan, never say die, people, eventually come back to him and said, look, can we use existing drawings to create the characters? And Hirschfeld thought that would be okay. And so they set about, and you need someone who was a great student of Hirschfeld to be able to do this. Because as you watch Rhapsody in Blue, I know that when we watch Rhapsody in Blue, we look at it and we can see all the Hirschfeld drawings.
Yeah, you know, all of them.
Oh, that's a background from this one.
And
oh,
some very obscure. Mitzi Mayfair?
Yeah,
I mean, definitely. I think, is that in World of Hirschfeld or Art and Recollections?
It's in American Theater.
Oh, American Theater? Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty obscure drawing, though.
Yes.
You know, and she's on a poster on a poster on a wall or something.
Sure. The George Gershwin obviously is based
There's a Harlem piece. Well, there's two Harlem pieces. Well, Apollo Corinne, and then of course the main character, the drummer, Solid Sender.
Yeah, is a lead character in the piece. And it's only when Fantasia 2000 runs into problem where Roy Disney says to Eric, "Hey, so how's that piece coming along?" And it gets incorporated into Fantasia 2000. And what I find very interesting is the New York Times, when they review it on New Year's Eve 1999.
Oh, man, they don't even know if it's going to make it to the press the next day. Jeez.
Stephen Holden writes, Rhapsody in Blue, the new version's second best episode, set to Gershwin and directed by Eric Goldberg, is a stylish visual homage to the caricaturist Al Hirschfeld. Here, a group of jazz-age Manhattan residents from every step of the social ladder collide in a witty, hyperkinetic evocation of the New York melting pot. Although we hardly get to know these characters, each is sharply defined. It's the only segment whose imagery completely transcends a Disney cartoony cuteness.
Mm.
And I think that's really telling. And it wasn't, of course the New York Times would want Hirschfeld's. They didn't, Hirschfeld was a work appeared in the Times, but he was not a member of the Times.
Right.
He did not work in the offices.
Was it on staff?
Yeah. They saw him, anybody working in the Times in 1999 would have grown up seeing his work in a variety of places. Stephen Holden, who reviewed Cabaret, might have seen Hirschfeld at a cabaret, would have been familiar with his drawings of Cabaret, but didn't necessarily see him as a Times person.
Mm-hmm.
He was just really pointing out that, you know, biased as I am, I obviously think it's the best segment of that film. Because a lot of that film is, you know, it's this combination of hand-drawn and computer-generated animation, which is wonderful in its own way. But again, I feel, and I didn't really know Hirschfeld's reviews at this time, but when I watched it, I was like, they're trying to, why recreate reality? I mean, it just seemed to me, it's so realistic looking. It's like, why do we need to have this? We could have the real people doing it. Whereas Rhapsody in Blue has such a freer feeling. You're in your own universe.
Mm-hmm.
This is not, it's a world that's tied, you know, it's sort of like a alternate version of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much sort of fun. It's a every part about it sort of crackles with a little bit of energy and has a little bit of humor and a little bit of wit. Whereas the other ones seem like very dutiful and stoic. And, you know, that might be work for somebody else, but it didn't scratch my itch.
Yeah, agreed. I've said it before on this podcast, but my brother and I loved Rhapsody in Blue from Fantasia 2000. That was always our favorite one to watch.
And I think it's very interesting because that I think it also looks at where animation's at the time with the computer animation. You know, it's very new. You know, it would have been like 4 or 5 years before Toy Story, the first CG computer animated film came out. And, you know, through that 90s, that Disney Renaissance era, as they call it, you know, they start incorporating CG into different sequences. You know, you look at the Beauty and the Beast, the ballroom sequence, the ballroom is constructed, that's CGI. You know, Aladdin, you get like with the magic carpet and a lot of the flying sequences. So they're like, you know, they're playing around with that technology. And I think it's very, it really parallels with, again, looking back at Hirschfeld's reviews and how they're still really developing hand-drawn animation. And I think what really does make Rhapsody in Blue stick out is it's very stylized, you know, like the use of color in it. It's very simple, but it's very effective in its own way. And I think that's just why, you know, it stands out very well. Also, with Fantasia 2000, I have made an interesting discovery. So now when they were making Rhapsody in Blue, they obviously, you know, found ways to incorporate Nina's name into it. But I found another discovery where they added, there's another name that's actually in the Rhapsody in Blue more than Nina. Can you guess what the name is?
I assume it's Eric Goldberg's daughter's name.
It's a name you're very familiar with.
David.
No. There's a lot of Dougs in Rhapsody in Blue. So apparently the background artist at Disney's name is Doug Walker, and I guess he shares Hirschfeld's sort of Joker, sort of, you know, having fun with it. So he added his name into the background of a lot of the different parts of the sequence, which, you know, obviously I was, you know, not around at the time, but I feel like it was really meant to be. I feel like it was there for a reason.
Yeah, I'm jealous.
Catherine is a little hard to pull off.
Wow. Jeez.
So if you watch that again, I'll have to go through and figure out how many Dougs are in it, because I do not know
that
yet.
That doesn't have the same ring. Count the Dougs. It's not as fun.
She says she's just jealous. She's just jealous. Well, as I said, there were animators who really studied Hirschfeld's work. One that he drew, I don't know how much impact he had, but in 1999, Hirschfeld drew Carl Barks, who is best known for Disney comic books, of all things. He really created Scrooge McDuck. And he is a very well-regarded Disney, I wouldn't say animator, but a Disney artist. But animators like Brad Bird and Pete Docter, I mean, they're directors of animated films. Pete Docter, when Up was nominated for Best Animated Feature, he said that, you know, while Hirschfeld used, you know, famously the pencil, the pen, and the bottle of the ink, Pete Docter and his crew are using the latest computer technology. He says, but nevertheless, he says, that sense of simplification and caricature in talking about Up is the same way that Hirschfeld will reduce the likeness of someone in just a few lines. The same can be done through design and movement and stripping away anything that's not the gesture that you're trying to portray. Simple, elegant, sophisticated reduction. That's what we're after. So you can see that looking to Hirschfeld would give you exactly that. You know, that's the thing you want to create. And Brad Bird, the Oscar-winning director of Ratatouille, also cited Hirschfeld as a significant influence. He said, when Al Hirschfeld did a drawing of a celebrity, it often looked more like the person than the person did. That's our goal in animation. If we're going to capture Paris, we aren't trying to perfectly reproduce the actual Paris. We're trying to reproduce the feeling of being in Paris. When we do movement for characters, we're trying to give the impression We're trying to give the impression of a character rather than perfectly mimicking reality. So Hirschfeld, here, these are 21st century directors working with computer-generated animation. And Al Hirschfeld was talking about the same thing nearly 75 years earlier. I mean, I think it's kind of remarkable.
And I think it really shows in their work. I mean, when you're talking about Brad Bird and Pete Docter, I mean, they are two of the core, like, early Pixar, you know, creators. I mean, Pete Docter is the chief creative officer now at Pixar. Especially, you know, I think about with Brad Bird, you know, his first film with Pixar was The Incredibles, which is the first Pixar film where the main characters were human characters, but they're not animated, you know, like they're not like sort of like a more straight, you know, photocopy of a human. I mean, they're very stylized. They're very, you know, each character has its own like very unique shape and curve to it. And I think each one are very distinctive. And I think it really, you know, speaks to that, you know, where I saw Pixar's latest film, Elemental, last year, you know, and it's about these, you know, we got fire, water, and other element people. And I remember leaving or while watching the film and also noting the shapes, you know, again, they were very curved, very unique shaped characters. And, you know, that's something where they had the freedom to really do what they want. And I really think they did take advantage of that. And I think you can see that a lot in Pixar's work especially, but I mean there's other, you know, there's a lot more animation studios now than there were in 1940, where you are seeing people taking advantage of the medium. And something that I was really delighted looking at Disney's 100th anniversary is they had the short film Once Upon a Studio, which Eric Goldberg was the head of 2D animation on. He's really one of the last, you know, 2D animators still at Disney.
That's hand-drawn animation.
Yes, 2D hand-drawn animation. I was very excited for it. It has over 500 characters from across Disney history since the beginning.
I thought it was 100.
It does not have 100. It does not have 100. It has over 500.
Disney 100. That would make a lot more sense.
Yeah, but then you...
See, you're suffering the Disney literal interpretation syndrome.
Look, Imagineer I'm not. Is that what they're called?
That's the parks.
Oh, okay.
Well, I saw the debut of Once Upon a Studio with Doug.
Oh, that's right.
We were actually in Mexico installing an exhibition, and it was phenomenal to see it with Doug because he pointed out so many things I would have missed.
Was Pocahontas in it?
Not only was she in it, she sang.
Oh wow, Judy Kuhn?
Yeah.
Wow, nice.
They got everyone back.
Wow. Yeah.
They even got people who were dead back.
Wow. Robin Williams.
Wow. They had really fun little sequence where Olaf from Frozen is drawing the genie, and I believe it's supposed to be Eric Goldberg's like desk he's drawing at, and then Nathan Lane as Timon's yelling him to, you know, get moving or whatever, and then all of a sudden the genie comes out of the drawing.
Oh man, like a Hirschfeld drawing.
you get that classic Alan Menken, you know, music cue, Friend Like Me, and then they picked this outtake of Robin Williams that they put into it, and I mean it was such a fun moment.
Fine.
But not only was the genie in Once Upon a Studio, but when you see at the very end where all 500 plus characters are taking a picture together, if you look in the sort of the left, you know, side of that picture, and if you get your magnifying glasses out as I did and look in the screen, because it's a lot of characters, the four main characters of Rhapsody in Blue are in the group picture.
Wow. Are any other characters from Fantasia 2000 in it?
There's the tin soldier, the whales.
Yeah, the whales would be hard.
The whales were not in it.
The other...
It might have been a flamingo.
Oh, flamingo.
Which was also
Eric
Goldberg directed as a sequence. So.
Yeah, that's another hand-drawn segment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All hail Eric Goldberg.
Well, very very cool.
It was very touching to see that. You know, we put out a social media post the next day when it was Disney's 100th anniversary. You know, we thanked them for it, and we got it. You know, it was a nice reception because then we had some of the works we talked about there.
So happy birthday, Disney Studios!
Yes, happy birthday, happy centennial.
Here's to another 100 years.
Oh boy.
We'll do our 200th anniversary.
Good news.
Podcast.
We will not be doing a podcast, the three of us.
They can bring Robin Williams back. By that point, they'll be able to do an AI podcast episode for us.
Folks, if you want an AI-produced Catherine Eastman podcast episode, please write info at alhirschfeldfoundation.org.
I'll still be talking about Pocahontas.
She records herself all the time just in hopes that, you know, that the day comes.
Yep.
Anyway, if you want to see more Hirschfeld work, please go to alhirschfeldfoundation.org. You can visit our shop at alhirschfeldfoundationshop.org. We've opened a new home decor shop, hirschfeldhomestyle.com. You can follow us on social media.
Facebook, the Al Hirschfeld Foundation, Instagram, Twitter, or X, excuse me, at Al Hirschfeld, the website formerly known as Twitter, and our YouTube page as well, which is it just Al Hirschfeld?
It's the Al Hirschfeld Foundation.
The Al Hirschfeld Foundation. If you type in Al Hirschfeld, we're always the first thing that comes up.
Yeah,
we got a lot of new projects coming up. There's going to be some more videos coming up. And then for the podcast, I hope you guys like this episode. And if you have any other suggestions, please write us because, you know, we always love coming up with new ideas.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you for listening. Thank you, Doug, for joining us and sharing with us your Disney knowledge. Again, I always thought I knew a lot about Disney.
You know more than most civilians.
I guess so, but you're the expert here. And so we're I'm very happy you joined us to give us stuff that I couldn't do.
No, really great.
Yeah.
Really great. Well, thank you, everybody. We'll look forward to seeing you when we do.
Bye.
Bye.